Professor Lee Lind of Dartmouth College, an internationally recognized expert in sustainable fuel production and related issues, delivered the 2013 address in the Winthrop Rockefeller Distinguished Lecture Series at the University of Arkansas this afternoon. He spoke on bioenergy, food, and the sustainable resource transition. I spoke with him before his talk. He began our conversation by saying that throughout history, an awful lot of things have been and are determined by a resource base for humanity.
And there was a time that human beings fed themselves, and their general activity during the day was hunting and gathering. And they would get food from a given area, and when that area was exhausted, they'd move on. And they didn't build permanent houses. So you can imagine what you valued and how you spent your time and what skills were important then versus now are completely different. And then there was this transition, which actually occurred over several millennia and isn't absolutely completely done now. There's still people that live in that mode, although not many. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the vast majority of human beings spent most of their days producing food. That's what people did. Well, you know, now in the United States, about 2% of people are directly involved in producing food, and most of us do very different things.
Well, and the people that do produce food, it's kind of, most of it's on a large scale.
Sure. In the United States, there's
right.
a lot of diversity in how food is produced worldwide. But yes, in the United States, most of the food is produced on very big farms by very few people. And the reason I mentioned these two prior resource transitions, or one might even use the term resource revolution, is that I think there's a lot of evidence that we're heading into a third, or perhaps the third major resource revolution, in the sense that when we leave the century that we're in now, there are an awful lot of indications we will need to be supported by sustainable resources and be using those resources in a sustainable way, which is a somewhat separate matter. This is a big, big, big transition. In the past transitions, there were many local experiments, not all of which had to work from the point of view of the human enterprise moving on. It's a much more integrated world. Changes are happening much faster. We have 7 billion people.
And it keeps growing.
Yeah, and don't think the world is yet taking this seriously enough. And so I spend a lot of time telling people that I think there's an issue, but I think there are solutions.
Okay. What are some of the solutions?
It's a matter of learning to live off of income rather than capital, resource income rather than resource capital. And so look at the things we do today, whether it's energy use, which is a major factor in all of this, or for that matter, land use. And we have to, you know, use land in a way that it remains usable. You can't really do that with energy, but at least we have to use energy in a way that doesn't deplete our energy capital. That's really the common denominator to the solutions as I see it. My personal activity tends to be focused on issues that involve land. And what brought me to this field was the idea of producing fuels from plants you can't eat. But that has brought me to a broader set of issues because we're not going to decide to produce fuel without considering the other things we can do with land and need to do with land, by the way, to feed people and to provide wildlife habitat and ecosystem services and the like. So
then we have this land battling for two uses, I guess, for energy and for food.
There are multiple uses and expectations we have of land, and it's certainly possible they can battle, but part of my thesis is it's not necessary that
okay.
they battle.
Okay. Okay. So your talk this afternoon is just that, bioenergy and food.
Yeah.
And how the two are related?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there are many relations. I think the ones people are most familiar with are potential negative interactions between using land to produce energy and using land to produce food.
Well, meaning like corn and ethanol, or? Well,
that's certainly a subject of criticism. We use about a third of the corn crop in the United States to produce ethanol at this point, and that provides something a little less, not a lot less, but a little less than 10% of our total gasoline. But I try to focus on win-win opportunities, if you will, and there's actually quite a few of them. For one thing, although the world's lands are rather fully occupied, they're not that fully utilized. And I've been looking particularly of late about pasture land. One curious thing about pasture land is that when the Food and Agricultural Organization, the FAO of the United Nations, classifies land, you know, forest land is land with trees, cropland is land with crops, deserts identifiable, tundras identifiable, and if you basically take the total land and subtract all those, what you have left is pasture.
So sort of, flat, not necessarily grassland, but...
Some of it's grassland, some of it's scrub. There's a huge diversity, but there's a lot of it. And there's a lot of evidence that globally, pasture land is not very fully utilized. In fact, only about 60% of it's occupied by animals, to start with. And of that, there's a tremendous amount of it that is not managed close to its potential. Perennials are a wonderful way to keep surface waters from having nutrients enter them. They can actually be used to regenerate soil fertility and reclaim land. They add diversity to landscapes. Soil carbon storage is a possibility. Increased farm revenue. In this part of the country, I was learning this morning, you grow a lot of winter wheat. But in other parts of the United States and temperate regions around the world, the ground is not planted for a significant fraction of the year. There can be added farm revenue from introducing winter cover crops with all sorts of advantages. It's hard to see who loses in that, provided you have a market for these perennial grasses. I've also, I lead something called the Global Sustainable Bioenergy Project, and we think a lot about, interestingly, the two areas in the world that probably have the greatest potential to grow biomass are Africa and South America. A significant group of people are starting to think along the lines that bioenergy can help food security in the poor places of the world, although it's been regarded in the past as something that would hinder it.
Which the poorest places are Africa and South America.
Yeah, there's some poor people in Asia as well. But the highest incidence of poverty and highest incidence of food security or insecurity in the planet is in Africa.
But they just don't have the means and the knowledge to do so?
It's in a nutshell, it's a result of institutional failures. And there's a lot of different institutions that can share part of that responsibility. But it's a human-made problem as opposed to a geographically limited situation. And actually, for example, the way food aid is administered is a contributing factor to the perpetuation of food insecurity. Food aid is administered for the benefit of the producers, which is, after all, where the policies are made that determine how the food aid is dispensed. I'm not saying there's never a use for it. I'm not saying that there aren't many well-intentioned initiatives. But nevertheless, my understanding and the understanding of people who've looked at this more closely than I have is that food aid, the way food aid is administered, perpetuates food insecurity in Africa. The fundamental insight, I think, is all involuntarily hungry people are poor. The big reason people are food insecure in a place like Africa is the absence of economic development. It's not the absence of land. And so it might first appear that, you're putting an added demand for land in a place where people are already starving. Isn't this a bad idea? But that kind of assumes that the land is limiting and that the jobs are not. It's actually the other way around. And so one has to be very careful about introducing an added demand for land. And one of the things my colleagues and I have suggested is, look, even on a local level, bioenergy should make food security better, not worse. So just put that as a constraint and move on.
Well, we were talking about corn and ethanol being not a great combination necessarily. And you mentioned that there are some good combinations. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, corn. Let me just comment quickly on corn and ethanol. There are arguments that if we did not have a corn ethanol industry, that we would either have many fewer farmers, or we would have lower corn prices. That would be good for some people. Corn prices were low for a long, long, long time. Up until about 2005, corn was on the order of $2 a bushel. I haven't looked lately, but it's been in the 5 to 7 and 8 range. Mm-hmm. And it's not expected to go back down anytime soon. And so for all of that time when the corn prices were low, the idea of keeping rural communities in business seemed like, and keeping farmers in business seemed like a great thing.
Corn farmers.
Well, when it was smaller, mm-hmm. it wasn't having as much impact. You know, there are now people very, my son is a dairy farmer in Vermont.
And it makes feed.
And he's not happy about, he and the other dairy farmers he knows in northern Vermont are not happy about what they're paying for corn. And
right, that's what I meant. It makes feed more expensive.
It certainly does. Yeah, hogs and poultry and all the rest of it. So corn is one of the easiest sources of readily fermentable plant matter. And that's why we make ethanol out of it. That's why it's the first thing, biofuel, we've done in this country. A significant factor over the decades that we've had a corn ethanol industry and that it's received governmental support of various kinds is increasing demand for things farmers know how to grow. There are other raw materials that can be used to make biofuels, and we can grow grasses, we can grow trees. Some people talk about growing algae, for example. Mm-hmm. All of this is photosynthesis. All of it potentially, including corn, is ways to tap into our energy income, because after all, this is a form of captured solar energy.
Which I believe there was a project at the university recently about using algae.
Yeah, yeah. You know, which of these raw materials, you know, will become the basis for, if any, for, you know, large-scale displacement of petroleum remains to be seen. A striking thing is, I don't know the local prices here, but if you look at, for example, what a paper mill pays for wood chips or what people pay for hay that doesn't have much protein in it, basically, in many parts of the country, $60 a ton is a round number. Turns out that's about $4 a gigajoule, so what? But that's equivalent to oil at about $25 a barrel. And so we're talking about a very cost-competitive raw material. And so why don't we do this now? Simple. We don't know enough about processing it. If we knew more about processing cellulosic biomass, the trees and the grasses and whatnot, we would be doing it. It's an interesting situation because photosynthesis has been on the Earth about 1.7 billion years, as far as we know. So then we want to process this stuff. And keep in mind, the purpose of a corn kernel, the biological purpose of a corn kernel, is to provide energy for the next generation. It's to make it through the winter.
Right. It's essentially a seed.
It is a seed.
Yeah.
At which time, its biological function is to be easy to take apart. So you've got this, you know, this little stirring life within the seed that needs to sort of commandeer these resources. You don't want those resources to be hard to mobilize, if you will. By contrast, the purpose of cellulosic biomass, the biological purpose, what it does for the plant, it's the structure. It holds it up. And therefore, it's evolved to be resistant to attack. And that is the origin of the technological challenge, that plants have evolved to be hard to take apart, and we're trying to take them apart. On the other hand, we don't need to get into the details, but I don't particularly think cellulosic biomass is inherently much harder to process than oil. It's just that we've been at it a lot less time. So I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to do this in time in a cost-effective way. And that's probably a good thing because, as anybody has noticed, the argument that we're going to be forced to find alternatives to fossil fuels because we're running out of them is getting harder to make. There may be other reasons that people would be concerned about mobilizing some of these resources, but you know, every time people think we may be running out of fossil resources, we seem to find more. And so there's this expression that the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. As we talk about this historical transition that needs to happen in the next century, or in this century, excuse me, in the next 100 years, I think we're going to have to rely on more than scarcity to drive us to do it, which makes it a bit more challenging.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Lind.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lee Lind is a professor of Dartmouth College. He spoke this afternoon in the Winthrop Rockefeller Distinguished Lecture Series at the University of Arkansas.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Tahlequah, Oklahoma. I'm Kyle Kellums. My special thanks to my colleagues Antoinette Grajeda and Christina Thomas for helping me with this evening edition of Ozarks at Large. Don't forget, you can make a pledge to support KUAF during this spring fundraiser easily and simply. You can do it right now. We don't have phone volunteers here. They won't be back till 6 tomorrow morning, but you can go online to our website, supportkuaf.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Christina, Antoinette, and the rest of the Ozarks at Large crew will be back tomorrow at noon for a brand new edition, a fundraising edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks to everyone who has contributed so far. Again, if you're thinking about it right now, you can use your smartphone app or go to supportkuaf.com. Have a very pleasant Tuesday evening. Try to stay dry. It's 8 o'clock.